Valvoline Instant Oil Change wants you to breathe out your oil change anxiety. And breathe in automotive peace. Visit us today. Valvoline Instant Oil Change will help ease your oil change anxiety. Picture expert technicians who are quick but not rushed. When you hear the bell, breathe in and out. Now, let go of your oil change anxiety. Visit Valvoline Instant Oil Change today and find automotive peace. No appointment needed.
What's happening, family, and welcome to the podcast In the Black of My Mind. I'm your host, Al Thomas. Do me a favor and go down to the bottom of the screen and click subscribe, like, and comment, please. And tell people about this. Tell everybody. How many bodies? Everybody's. Tell everybody about the podcast. I'm excited about the podcast today. Our guest is an amazing trombone player. He's performed and recorded with and or toured with the likes of Sheila E., Bootsy Collins, The Gap Band, Stanley Clark, George Duke, David Sanborn, Eric Benet, Alex Bouillon, Mike Phillips, Richard Smallwood, The Third World, and Prince, just to name a few. Welcome to the podcast, Greg Boyer.
Yeah, thank you very much, man. I mean, you left out my main gig, which is P-Funk.
I was getting ready to go there.
Let me just sit back and let you do your thing.
No, man. By all means, feel free to jump in and interject and anything you got, man. Just bring it, bro. For real. Yeah, man. But how you feeling though, bro?
I'm doing great, man. I'm doing great. I happen to have a night off from a ton of activity lately. It seems like if it's not traveling to do some gigs or doing gigs locally, it's some sitting here writing horn charts for somebody. And I did a recording session earlier today. So, you know, and it's funny too, man. Everybody is like, well, man, COVID slowed us down. I feel like I'm busier now on this side of COVID than I was prior to.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because most of the musicians that I've talked to, they're just starting to get themselves back up to speed and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
So many brothers and sisters that just were shut down and couldn't do anything, and so if you weren't able to teach or had a little recording situation at home or you know, writing for somebody, you was just caught out and stuff, man.
Yeah, that whole time was a very humbling experience. You know, all those things that you took for granted for years, I mean, nobody saw that coming.
Right.
You know, even though, you know, there were things set up by the government that were, you know, in place to kind of like ward off, if not, you know, slow down something like that.
Right.
But, you know, I'm not going to get all political and talk about how, you know, certain administrations jumped in and just put stuck a fork in the balloon.
And
then we were stuck with what we had. Hey, man.
We don't need this.
That stands for salt. Throw this away.
Exactly. Man, please. Yeah, you're right there. We'll keep it above board today.
Yes. Yeah.
But, you know, go calm.
Because we're getting enough of that, man. We can do without it. Let's take a break from all of that.
Mercy. Yeah. It's interesting you say that because a lot of times I just got to turn it. I got to turn. I just can't. Yeah. I can't take it anymore, man. You know. But it is what it is, though. Interesting times.
It's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Where were you born?
I was born in Bryan's Road, Maryland.
Born and raised there.
Yes. Uh-huh. And everybody's like, huh? That's the street. What's the name of the town? The name of the town is called Bryan's Road, and it got its name from my great grandfather had a store. And the guy that brought the mail around would dump the mail at the store. And his name was Mr. Bryan. He was the guy. And they just adopted the name of Bryan's Road because that was pretty much his territory, his mail route.
Wow.
If anybody has been in or near D.C., you've probably heard of Indian Head or Waldorf or something like that. So, you know, it's in that area, but considerably smaller.
I'm sure.
The town has one stoplight, four gas stations, and a ton of liquor stores.
Oh. Wow.
Yeah.
Because I thought I saw something like that, and I was like, well, now I got to ask him because that don't sound right, man. But
It's plenty correct, but you know, the explanation has to come with it. Otherwise, you're going to be having that quizzical look in your eye.
Exactly, as did I.
Yeah, but it's about a half hour south of Washington, D.C.
Brothers and sisters?
Yes, two of each. Older brother and sister, younger brother and sister. I'm right in the middle.
Oh, okay. Any of them involved in the arts?
They all kind of like took a stab at it. You know, both my brothers, you know, messed around with trumpet a little bit, and my sisters messed around with flute.
Okay.
And my parents, no, all my parents played were records.
Nice. Yeah, well, see, that's where you got your musical taste from initially.
Yeah, that's exactly where it came from. You know, we only had one turntable in the house, so there was hierarchy involved. You know, our parents played what they wanted to hear first,
right,
which mostly was jazz, and that's what really got me on board with that. And then it started with my older brother, who was into James Brown and funk.
Okay.
And then he would put his white Chucks on and his Peter's jacket and go out and hanging with his friends.
Nice.
I'm telling on myself now.
No, man, that's us.
Yeah. and then it's my sister's turn, you know, it was all Motown and Memphis Soul. That's where we developed our taste from. Of course, you know, we were too young to buy anything.
So we
were just listening to whatever. And then when they were done, we would play their records.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that's funny. There's three of us, and I'm the oldest. So, but my dad was the one that brought in tons of music and stuff, you know. And as you said, it was jazz, man. And you know, so as a little kid, you know, that's all I knew. So, man, he's like, Pop, put on that Wes Montgomery, man.
Yeah,
you know? Man.
And it's a thing too, because you know, everybody had a big music. Some kind of system in their house, you know, speakers, a turntable, and nobody has that anymore. If you look around at people's houses, man, nobody's got music set up. It's either something very personal, like a phone, or you play music in the car on your radio or something like that, and that's it.
One little Bluetooth speaker or something like that.
And that doesn't expose the house to different music. So, you know, kids coming up now, man, and you would think that they would know who Sly Stone was, or they might barely know Prince or Michael Jackson.
Right.
You know, but yeah, you know, they're just totally out of touch with the music. So what you get is a lot of stuff that's, you know, all sounds the same. It's like, it's more commercial based than it is based on the merit of how good the music is.
So. And that's unfortunate too.
Yeah.
You know, now it's as you know, it's a popularity contest.
Yeah, that's definitely what it is. So you know, it's my job as a grandfather to expose those kids to some different music the same way my parents exposed me.
Exactly.
And hopefully their parents, you know, my daughters and sons will expose them to something too.
Yeah, no, it's just unfortunate, man, because you know, now it's like a beat, but there's no bridge, there's no chorus, there's no textures. There's no.
I mean, they're quick to say, look, they're not saying I got tracks anymore. I got some songs. They're saying they have beats.
Beats.
The song has been reduced to a squirrely little synthesizer line and a drum machine.
Yeah.
You know, people going on tour with 10 dancers and a laptop.
Then I'll never forget. I took my daughter to the Scream tour years ago.
Okay.
And so I'm there. All right. All right. I'll take you and her and my niece. And I'm sitting up there and I'm like, all right, we're in a stadium, an arena, excuse me. And I'm like, I don't see no drums. I don't see no amps. I don't see just microphone stands. And that was it. And you know, I was like, oh, you got to be kidding me. As much money as these tickets cost, somebody better get up there and play something, a guitar or somebody, a keyboard.
We're not even going to talk about ticket costs now.
Oh, I know. I know.
People charging four figures for a ticket on a regular. This isn't just creme de la creme.
Right.
Everybody's asking that. And I mean, we could go see five bands and open seating for like $8.
Oh, yeah. Exactly.
And they all had hits.
Yes.
You know,
great musicians. I saw Miles Davis, and I think I paid $9 to see Miles.
Man, I never got to see Miles play. I had a chance to meet him, but I was like, there's no way in the world I'm going to go down to his hotel room at 12 in the afternoon and say, hey, Mr. Davis, you know?
right.
I know the stories, man.
Yeah.
Let that man see some daylight first before I even go up one, right? You know?
Oh, man. So when did you start playing music?
Really playing, I started at about 9 years old.
Okay.
And my dad had a plastic harmonica on the top shelf in his closet. You know, I'm a little kid and all of that stuff is off limits, but I was so curious about that thing. I had to wait until he left the house to get on a chair or something, get up in there and get it. And I'm playing around with it. I'm learning all these songs and stuff.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I'm like, you know, harping it, man.
Right.
And wasn't paying attention. He came home and caught me with that in my hand.
Oh, no.
But instead of him blowing a gasket, you know, he just like, you know, fuck it. You can keep it.
So playing it better than me anyways.
It became my buddy, man. I was playing all the time. I took a bath, man. It was a boat, you know. And I stuck it underwater too long, and I drowned it, and it never worked again.
Oh, man. Wow.
But the year after that, I got my first horn, or the alto saxophone that I gotten from my uncle, who played when he was younger.
Okay.
And that's what opened the gate to really playing.
Okay. Alto sax.
Yeah.
I read somewhere that said that by the time you left high school, you could play every instrument in the band.
Oh, yeah. Mm. I was instrument curious. I was like, I see people play these things, and I said, what do you have to do to make things work? Mm. And with strings, you make them shorter, the notes go up. Mm. With the woodwinds, you open up more holes, the notes go up.
Right.
With brass instruments, you just tighten up on your lips and you're playing higher. And then, you know, something like a xylophone or whatever, the piano, all that stuff is self-explanatory.
Right. It's out in front of you. Yeah.
So, and drums, you know, if you hold your sticks right and you hit the right rhythm and know what it looks like on paper, I didn't think it was a big deal. Because I just thought, oh, anybody could figure this out. And I might have been wrong.
Yeah, I think you were.
Yeah, I took all of that for granted, even perfect pitch. You know, I thought, well, anybody could do this because it didn't seem like anything outstanding to me. So, you know, you're asking around and everybody's like, oh, man, nobody has that. And I was like, oh, OK, well,
right.
No,
right,
c'est la vie. I got a built in cheat code. Let me see what I can make out of this.
Oh, man. What I was reading, I went on to say that you, your primary focus when you got through high school was classical tuba.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Now, before classical tuba, I had my eyes set on playing baseball professionally.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I could bat left and right handed.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I
what
wasn't.
Position?
Any position.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I like to pitch. You know, I kind of had a little halfway decent little knuckleball and, you know, all kinds of delivery and stuff. You know, this is early on. You know, I hadn't really gotten to the point where it's like, can he excel at this or not? I just love the game.
Right.
And when you got to 13 years old, you start playing on a regular size field and the ball's coming by you a little faster.
Yeah.
And
oh, yeah.
I'm up there hitting and somebody throws me one high and tight and you can hear the seams whistling. And had I not leaned back, that ball would have hit me in my jaw or something. And all I'm thinking was, man, if it hit me in my jaw, I wouldn't be able to play in band tomorrow.
Oh, right.
And I was like, well, maybe that should be my focus. So, yeah, I had designs on playing classical tuba. I was playing tenor sax in a local band at age 15.
Okay.
I was playing bass in church at 14.
Oh, wow.
And I was playing trombone in the high school big band.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just everywhere. You know, I didn't really find a home until maybe I got in college when I finally decided I'm going to be a trombone player.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. You know, I was in the military and going back to you, you being a tuba player, I was in the military and stationed at Fort Myer. And I had a friend of mine that was at Howard on a baseball scholarship. And so I used to go over there and hang out with them. Unfortunately, I don't think they have a baseball anymore over there. But I used to go hang out with them. And this was in February. I went to, he said, man, let's go to a basketball game. All right, so we go over there to the gym and we go sit up by the band.
Right.
And so I'm sitting next to the tuba player. Band's to my left. So it's February of 1978. I'll never forget, man. It's the beginning of February. And the tuba player, it's all of a sudden you hear, and I was like, no, the band is playing Flashlight, man. And the tuba player was killing it. Now, the Flashlight had only been out like a week or two when they were playing it, you know?
Well, I remember Flashlight coming out. It caught fire quick.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And see, I mean, I'm from Connecticut, man. So, you know, we got some funk, but not in the marching bands and stuff, man.
No.
John Philip Sousa and stuff, that march music.
Yeah.
Nah, man.
Now, there's a funny thing, because Marcus Miller even mentioned that talking to one of the guys I was playing bass with. He said, man, y'all must grow funk out the ground down there in D.C.
Exactly. Exactly. I think that, in fact, I talked to you about this when I met you years ago, and I was like, oh, man, I know this brother don't remember me, but you guys had played that outdoor concert at Yale. I think you said you caught a cold that gig, too. But it was an outdoor concert at Yale, and I think you and Greg Thomas were walking up to get something to eat, and me and my bass player we were walking down to the school, and I was saying that I had been I was down in the area and that I saw the Chocolate Jam. You said you was at the Chocolate Jam. I said, yo, that was my first concert with P-Funk. I was like, really?
Yes,
it was amazing.
And it's funny you brought up Yale because I had just broken my foot.
I was on
crutches that gig. We were up at, I think it was Cornell.
Okay.
Up there in upstate New York. Mm-hmm. And everybody in the band got these kangaroos. Like, it was sponsored by somebody anyway. Uh-huh. And, you know, tennis shoes with pockets on the side.
Right.
So I was like,
I remember.
And I was like, I like free stuff. So I put my free tennis shoes on. I'm out there on the court with a pair of running shoes.
Oh.
And bad mix. I came down wrong on that, and I could hear something go bop, like somebody dropped a brick on the floor.
Mm.
And I was like, oh, man, you know, my foot kind of hurt. Then I looked down, man, it was turning purple, it was swelling up.
Oh, dang.
And so, yeah, I had broken my foot a couple of days before that Yale concert. And it was the only time in my life that I had to use crutches.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. For all that madness I've done, climbing up trees, bicycles, Harleys, all of that stuff. The only time I
Only
ever
time.
needed crutches was when I broke my foot that day.
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
Dang. Oh, man. I was going to ask you a question. It slipped my mind just that quick. We at that point where if you don't write it down, it's a wrap.
Up in Connecticut, Chocolate Jam, met you there.
No, I mean, but that was I brought it up because of the Chocolate Jam and stuff, because
Yeah.
I was like, wow, because you're saying that was your first gig with them. Be prior to that, what would you say was the largest audience you had played in front of?
We played at Grant Park in Atlanta. And if I get the number right, they said it was 130,000 people
Oh,
in the
when you were
park
with
that day
P-Funk.
when I was with
No,
P-Funk.
I'm
Yeah.
talking about prior to joining
Oh,
P-Funk.
prior to that. Oh, shoot. Nothing in an arena. The biggest crowds I had was like an assembly or a church or something like that.
Gotcha.
And
Gotcha.
the progression was like rapid. I was playing in little juke joints down at St. Mary's College, I mean St. Mary's County, for like a dollar a night on dirt floors and stuff. And
Oh,
then
wow.
I got the call to play with P-Funk. It's like, okay, I went and auditioned and we got the gig. And next thing I know, we playing in 15, 20,000 seat arenas. So I never got to gradually work my way up to that. I went from way down there to way up there quick.
Exactly. So, like,
Yeah.
when you're up there, where do you go from there?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's more of them. The only thing after that is television,
Oh,
millions of viewers and yeah.
Yeah, I remember P-Funk was banned from television for a long time prior to them getting on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it's funny because I see some clips of them being on TV from like early 70s. They were on certain shows, and George was just wild, rolling around on the floor and wearing anything and stuff. But yeah, after that early, I'm gonna say that might have been 73 when they released Cosmic Slot. I hadn't seen them anywhere on TV. No. What is it called? Don Kirshner's rock concert, Midnight Special, any of that. But George told me that that was the downfall of live music because you took an experience that you had to be in an arena to get and reduced it to the size of a TV screen. Now, I understand that, but on the other side of that, you got to see and hear a lot of bands that you wouldn't have otherwise. So for me, it went both ways. But yeah, it was a long time before we were on television again. And I can't say when exactly, but I remember us being on Saturday Night Live in 1986. Yeah, the reason why I remember that, because it was Benny's birthday. So yeah, and I had my son was a couple months old, so and yeah, we did that. We played medley, Let's Take It to the Stage, and then we did one of Fries Go With That Shake and Standing on the Verge.
Oh,
And
man.
yeah. And then
Wow.
after that it became, Grammys and then other situations where P-Funk might have been on TV and David Letterman and stuff like that. But yeah, it was a long time before they were on TV.
Man, I remember the first time I saw them was, I think, it was 73 at the Apollo. And the
Yeah.
cats came out. One guy was dressed like a pilgrim,
Yeah.
with the buckles and all of that, and the stockings
Yeah.
and everything. Somebody else was dressed like a mummy. I forgot what George came out of a coffin, everybody, it was real eclectic. Somebody walked out, they had a suit of armor on and stuff, man. I don't know, where the heck do you get a suit of armor, man? But yeah, it was, that was my first time seeing them. And then I'm you know, some heads, some people are like Deadheads, and they, you know, everywhere when the Dead is out, you know, they go see him, Grateful Dead.
Right.
I'm definitely a funk head, man. So every time I could see P-Funk, I would go. I've probably been to, I don't know, maybe about 65, 70 concerts at this juncture.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's funny that you mentioned Deadheads, because Jerry Garcia died early 90s. And it was like all of those kids had nowhere to go. Mm. And they gravitated toward P-Funk. I was like, okay. But then when I look, you know, the red and blue logo skull with a lightning bolt.
Right, right.
And the tie-dye colors, the extended jams.
I was just getting ready to
The big personality with the rainbow hair front. I was like, it was almost predestined. So we would get a lot of those Deadheads. You know, they would get their mama and daddy's credit card and just follow the band around for a month.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Wow. So being down there in the DMV, I'm sure you must have played a lot of go-go.
Yeah, I played a lot. I played with Chuck Brown.
Did you?
From 1989 all the way up to the present. You know, even after his passing,
okay,
the band is still going. His son Wiley is fronting the band now.
Okay.
Yeah, so, yeah, they're still doing it and still going strong.
He plays guitar? No,
he doesn't play guitar, but he does sing. He looks and sounds just like his father.
Wow.
Then I remember right after Chuck passed, and Wiley got up there and was doing the song Chuck Baby, he sounded so much like his father, the whole front row started crying.
Oh, man, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Man.
He gets it honest.
No, I know that's right. Yeah. I was down there from 77 to 79, and so I got a chance to see Chuck in at a hotel ballroom and stuff.
To see Trouble?
Trouble Funk? I'm trying.
Trouble
to
Funk,
see.
Yeah.
Yeah, did I see Trouble? I'm not sure. My head was so bad back then, man. them's the Kool-Aid acid test years and stuff, man.
Oh, so, yeah. I'm thinking of the bands that were really getting the work done back then.
Yeah.
Along with Chuck, it was Trouble Funk. EU had gone from just an R&B band to playing go-go.
Oh, okay.
And...
Yeah, no, I did see Trouble Funk. I take that back. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, I've played with Chuck, Backyard, Little Benny and the Masters, Sluggo. Did I say Trouble?
Yes.
Played with Trouble. Mm. Only recently.
Oh.
But I made my way around a few of the go-go bands down here.
Mm. Yeah, and it's unfortunate that it's just go-go is in the DMV area for the most part, and then, I mean, New York and Connecticut and Massachusetts, they're not really into go-go, unfortunately.
No. The thing about go-go is you have to be there.
Yeah.
You can listen to a record and get a lot of it.
Yeah.
You can watch a video and get a lot of it. But there's nothing like being in the building.
Yeah.
When they start cranking and that tribal, funky groove kicks up, and then you start getting the rapport with the audience.
Yeah.
You know, they shouting out birthdays, neighborhoods, maybe even flashing a few signs and everything.
Mm.
And yeah, you can't get that. So in order for anybody else from outside the country to get it, you have to come here, because it's not going to be the same if you say, I'm going to do a go-go gig in Chicago. The audience won't get all of it. So the circuit is cut.
Mm.
It is super dependent on audience participation.
Right, right. Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
How did you get started professionally?
I was in school, playing, like I said, a few bands off campus. And I mean, to me, if you get paid to play, that's a
That's
professional.
professional. That's
But
right.
that really wasn't, I barely made like go to the store and get some Pop-Tart money playing off campus.
Okay.
But yeah, but before that, I was like 15 years old, and it was just one of those things where I can do this. All I need to do is find somebody that's willing to hire me. So I spoke to one person, that person, and they said, "Hey, man, you can play sax with us." I was like, "Cool." And I was jumped on the scene, man. And I was Little Grover Washington right off the bat because
Nice.
I could play that solo for Mr. Magic. If not note for note, I made it sound a lot like the original. So, and club owners, they were cool. And they said, "Look, we'll let you play, but don't try to step to the bar. We ain't giving you a thing." And I was riding with people. I was too young to drive, so trumpet player, he was driving, he'd pick me up. And then when I got old enough, I borrowed my parents' car and drive around and stuff. But I was in college in my third semester, and Benny Cowan and I, and anybody that doesn't know, Benny Cowan and I went to St. Mary's College, Southern Maryland, together back in 76 and 77. And same band that I was playing with, 2 years before I even went to school down there. I was leaving high school, half a day drive down there to rehearse and play with the band. But we got the wild idea to go hang with this guy from Baltimore all day. We left school like 6 in the morning, and we driving up to New York, met Eddie Kendricks.
Oh,
We
wow.
stopped at I think it's Sigma Sound or whatever it is, the big studio in Philly where the TSOP was in there doing a recession. So we got to listen to them, and all these guys, the symphony cats, gray hair with the shirts tucked in. And we would hang with Fat Larry. So we were going around saying that we were arrangers, I had my little leather briefcase and a few pencils and some staff paper in there. So if they looked in there, they would say, "Okay, he must be serious. He's carrying his tools with him." But man, I was green as a pickle. They knew better. And so we get back to school the next day. We had missed rehearsal to go do all of this. So we had a Christmas concert coming up down there at St. Mary's, and Benny was playing first trumpet. And he got demoted to fifth trumpet because he missed rehearsal. And
Oh, man.
I was playing bass trombone, so I couldn't go any lower. So they just said, "Well, no solos for you." And we were smelling ourselves. He's like, "What do we need school for? We've been hanging out hobnobbing all day. What if we put energy into that?" So we both dropped out of school at the end of 1977, December 1977. Meet this person, knows that person, somebody knows somebody in P-Funk, and that would be Greg Thomas,
Oh,
saxophone player.
okay.
And he had played in a band with Skeet when he was in high school,
Oh, wow.
and Skeet was like, "Hey," told Greg, "get a horn section together. There's an opening at P-Funk." So we were already playing, in another project that kind of fell through the floor. And we learned the album Funkadelic. Went out to a hotel where P-Funk was staying, showed them we could play it. And that was in February 78. In March of 78, they sent us plane tickets to say, "Come out on the road." So in little less than 3 months, totally unrelated, we had quit school and then we're playing with P-Funk. And it's just one of those things where you didn't have to audition. We hadn't had to audition against anybody else, let's put it that way. But I tell people all the time, based on that experience and a couple of ones after that, if you stay ready, you don't have to get ready. And I've been in situations where I wasn't ready and I went to audition or went to play and an opportunity passed me by. So but that's all it was, man. It's being the right place at the right time, knowing the right person.
Wow. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't that you that was up there with the biker shorts and the biker hat and stuff?
Yeah. That was me.
Yeah.
Now, I got married in 1983.
Uh-huh.
And prior to that, I was like, you know, an avid cycling fan. You know, I had the whole, you know, Jimmy get down to one piece and the shorts and all
right,
of that.
Right.
And I said, I'll make this part of my stage persona.
Right.
So when we weren't on tour with P-Funk, I was working as a bicycle messenger in D.C. No, really.
Okay.
Other than playing music, that might have been the best job I ever had.
Really?
I was in the shape of my life.
Oh, okay.
The money was good because this is before email and FedEx and right. all of that stuff. It was good money. If I left to do anything and I came back, I didn't have to work myself up through the ranks. And we were essentially the rock stars of downtown.
Mm,
And I even got featured on the news once.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, somebody came up with a microphone and, you know, asked me questions. What do you think of this? And I was saying nothing.
Nice.
But that was my passion. You know, I really picked up cycling at that point. Now, on the subject of the gear, do you remember seeing anybody wearing cycling gear prior to that?
No.
So there you go. I might have been at the forefront of an 80s trend, you know. Oh,
definitely.
Bike shorts and the whole gear and everything. And
all these years later, I remembered it, you know what
yeah.
I mean? So, yeah, definitely. I said, yeah, I think that had to have been him. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And, you know, soon after that, you know, everybody in the band was wearing it. And then you see other bands wearing theirs. And
right.
Then,
right.
It, you know, it slipped over to the rock and roll world. You know, everybody was doing the spandex over there and everything.
Right.
But, yeah, you know. I'm Grandpa Lycra.
Nice. So you played with P-Funk for a long time, and then you bounced.
Yeah, I played with him from 78 until 96. So that was roughly 19 years, and mm-hmm. I had just, you know, kind of had my fill of it at that point. I was, you know, I wasn't a kid anymore.
Right,
you know, this wasn't like ooh ah moment. You know, I was trying to, you know, really be about my business.
Right, right.
And I couldn't. I just felt like I was being in a stagnant situation with P-Funk.
Gotcha.
And I left.
Mm-hmm.
I did. I just, you know, packed up my toys and my cookies, man. I went somewhere else and, you know, played around the city and was doing all this stuff for a while. And then I hooked up with Maceo.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And the story behind that was Fishbone called me and said, can you play trombone and keys? I said, yes. Hmm. And I said, how much? And they told me, I'm like, man, I'm making that money right here at home. You know, because I was, you know, this was
go get that. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Chuck Brown was like gigging a lot back then.
Hmm.
So, you know, I was in the neighborhood between Chuck, Churches, other jazz gigs and all of that stuff, man. I was stacking them up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I was like, no, I appreciate the offer, but no. But they said, look, we're going to be at the Bayou in DC when it was still there.
Uh-huh.
And they said, you have an inkling, you know, come on through and check us out. You know, just, you know, as a camaraderie, you know, just whatever. And I went down there and sat in with them. And Maceo happened to be the headliner that night.
Oh, wow.
And somebody heard and he said, hey, Greg, how you doing? I know Maceo since, you know, P-Funk days.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, you want to sit in on a song? I was like, yeah, sure. So I went and played with him. And he asked me, look, the situation comes up. Would you be willing to do a couple of weeks with the band as a sub? I said, yeah.
Mm.
And I did. So we did 2 weeks over in Europe. And that was done. And then he said, well, I got a couple of weeks in September. Would you be willing to do that too? I said, sure.
Hmm.
And that couple of weeks in September ended up being all the way up until COVID.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Right. Wow.
Yeah, so yeah, I started playing with Maceo in 1998, all the way up until he retired.
Oh, he did retire.
He's
Okay.
retired.
All right. Yeah, I mean, I'd heard rumors, but then I was like, nah, he ain't retiring,
Yeah, no, he's retired, man. He finally got to the point where, well, first off, when we were playing with him, he would wear the band out. You know,
man.
we'd be ready to quit, and he's like, "Let's go play some more. Let's play some more." You know, people ain't going nowhere, and we were like, "Oh man, come on, come on." But I think it finally got to the point where the road wore him out, and he retired. Remember, we were flying back from, we were in Germany, and probably the day before they shut all of the airports down, we managed to get out. And when he got back home, he says, "I'm not doing this anymore." Yeah, just like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I had Brent Burkhead on the podcast
Oh man,
a couple of weeks ago, and
yeah, Brent, that's my dude,
is
man.
that right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. He was saying that he was in Europe and got stuck over there. Well, didn't I mean he was just able to get out, you know, and then they shut everything down afterwards and stuff. So
Yeah, we
that's.
were in the south of France. We had to go all the way to Frankfurt, Germany to get a flight out. So that would be the equivalent of maybe, let me see, where we are now, like maybe driving to from DC to Chicago. No, DC to Detroit to get out. You
To
know,
get out,
it was a nice little drive, but you know, it's the only way we could get home. Yeah.
Wow, that's tough. So, how did you hook up with Prince?
Prince was doing a session. You know, he's recording something. He kept trying to, well, he tell sax player, play such and such like Maceo. And he went, no, more like Maceo. Da-da-da-da. So he got the bright idea, why don't I just go hire Maceo?
Okay.
And he came to see us, and you know, it's like, you know, Maceo did a couple of things. And then he really made a pitch for Maceo to come join his band. And you saw us playing together. And he said, and bring that trombone player with you.
Oh,
Because
wow.
Maceo and I had such great chemistry on stage. I pride myself on the fact that I was able to shadow everything he played, you know, with the same nuance, the same inflections, the same phrasing, and even the harmonies were so Macy, all he had to do was think of it. And in a minute, it was like, you know, recording session ready. So, and yeah, he didn't want to break up the set. You know, it was like, okay, got the salt, bring the pepper too. And that's how I ended up playing with Prince.
And so what was that like? Well, rehearsing and touring and stuff with them.
Oh man, it was relentless. It's no, really, the rehearsals, it was like being, I say this all the time, but it was a musical equivalent of being in the fire department. And the respect that you could be minding your own business, not doing anything at all, and you hear, whoop, 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 be downstairs and dressed and ready in an hour. We're going to do an after party. Or, you know, any one of a number of things. Like for musicology, as an example, we rehearsed for almost a month, 10 hours a day. Then we did a couple of shows in LA. He's like, okay, that went nice, but I need to rehearse some more before I really go out there and do this nationwide tour. He was a perfectionist, but then on top of all of that, he didn't want you to rest on your laurels. Like once you got it good and sharp, then he said, okay, I'm going to change this part. I'm going to add this song. So you never got a minute's rest to be able to say, okay, I got this. I'm really, you know, rolling with it now. But,
Don't
you
get
know,
too
but
comfortable.
it don't get comfortable. But, you know, that was the musician Prince. The person Prince was not like what you would see on stage, you know. Yeah. Now, my wife who was pretty much adopted by Rick James back in the late 70s. No, really.
Really?
She was. And the thing was, if she got good grades, he would let her go on a tour for the summer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You know, he would give up his own personal bus and he would just fly everywhere. Mm-hmm. And then she had the bus to herself, you know, much to the chagrin of the rest of the band that was on piled up on another bus. But anyway, during that time, Prince was opening up for Rick. And I'm sure you heard the stories about, you know, the tete-a-tete, the back and forth and stuff, which is nowhere near as bad as it's been portrayed. But you know, these were kids, they were riding around in station wagons. They had the youthful exuberance of being on the road. And my wife was like, I like them a lot better because they're fun kids, you know, almost maybe a little bit older than her, but not much. Mm-hmm. And, you know, instead of, you know, being around all these grown ass men that are looking at her just like, you can't do this, you can't do that, you're underage.
Right, she
knew Prince back then. Mm. Now, fast forward to when I got in the band, she looked at us just like, what happened to him? You know, he's all serious. He's not fun anymore. I said, baby, he's famous.
And
that's what happens when you get famous. You don't have privacy anymore.
No.
So, but there were times where I got to see the old Prince, you know, the one that was the practical joker, the one that laughed a lot and that kind of stuff. It wasn't often because let's face it, you know, the only time we were around because we were working. But there were instances where I got to see, you know, that Prince from back in the day. And I was like, man, he was something else.
Well, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But I'm heavy is the head that wears the crown.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
As strong as the neck that holds the head that wears the crown.
No doubt. So, I mean, I'm sure at this juncture, man, you've done all kinds of tours. Anything memorable? Anything that crazy things happen on the road?
Shoot, man, that's an encyclopedia by itself.
Well, give me a couple of instances, man.
God, where do I start? And you know what? I should actually prepare myself for such a question before I boot up and sign on to these things. I always get caught with my mouth hanging open, trying to figure out. Oh well. But I know there was one instance in particular, you know, where Prince, staunch vegan, you know, he doesn't even like the concession stands to cook hot dogs if he's playing in an arena.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He, you know, really, 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 you know, against meat, no meat at all. Mm-hmm. So we're at this after party and everybody's huddled, you know, back in the whatever the little room there is for the band, you know, waiting for Prince to give the signal to go play. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm somewhere, I don't know, probably just making sure some people got in. I had maybe some guests or something, or just out there chopping it up, taking pictures or whatever. But I'm taking my sweet ass time getting back to this room. Mm-hmm. And so when I get there, Prince is already there. And he hasn't really made any move toward the stage yet. So I just look at him. I said, man, sorry, I'm a little bit late, man. I was out there and somebody was trying to smuggle some liquid chicken up in here. Now, nobody wants to laugh, right? Because I made a meat joke at Prince. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me like I was on fire. He just looked at me like, you are out of your mind. And he started laughing. And that was everybody else's cue to laugh.
Okay, okay.
But I just remember that. And I was like, you know, first off, to be in a situation where I would have to use liquid chicken as a punchline. and then, you know, to get away with it with the boss, you know, because he, you know, he could be a little bit surly at times. Another instance that came to mind, we playing in London. Mm-hmm. And I go home, I fly home because, you know, for Chuck Brown's birthday every year, they had this big thing over 9:30 Club. So I didn't want to miss it. I flew home. We had a couple days off. On my way back, red light came on the plane. And it was oil pressure or something.
Oh.
And they had to turn around and land a plane in in Newfoundland.
Uh-huh.
So between them landing a plane and getting another plane to take us over, I missed the concert when I got back to London. And Prince was hot. And I was like, okay, I get it. You know, I'm hot too. But at the same time, I'm alive. I didn't crash into the ocean. So I'm a little bit, you know, grateful with this. So next day we had soundcheck / rehearsal. And I walk over to Prince and I was like, wanted to apologize, man. And I said, hey, man, it was out of my hands. And he walked away from me.
No.
Yeah. He like, I don't want to hear it. And that DC came out. I said, no, man, we're going to talk. And he looked at me. He's like, soundcheck is over. We're talking in the dressing room. So I went in his dressing room where he's got candles and little purple silk curtains hanging all over the place. Mm. It looked like somebody was going to walk in there with some grapes, a bowl of grapes, and somebody else going to walk in there with some feathers and fan them.
Right, it looked like that, right? Wow.
And smelling all good in there with them little Prince candles and everything. I'm like, man, I might not ever leave here. But he was telling me how he once fired Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis because they missed a gig because of a blizzard.
Right, right, right.
Which, let's face it, you know, they're plentiful up in Minneapolis.
Hmm.
And I was like, hey, man, like I said, nothing I could do. He looked at me and he says,
after all of that, were you scared? And I told him, I pray before every flight and I say thank you when the plane lands. I ain't scared of nothing in between.
Hmm.
And you got to do that because them Jehovah Witnesses, you know, they always want to, you know, come and get you, you know, join the team or whatever.
Right, and so...
Once he saw that even with the clown antics and the gregarious demeanor and everything, that I had some spiritual foundation, he ain't messing with me no more.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, I remember that, man. I was like, I said, no, I wasn't chicken.
Right.
I like, I'm not dead until I can't feel anything anymore. You know, as long as I'm alive, that's what I am, alive. So.
Alive. Yeah.
Wow. You know, what I like to say all the time, I tell my wife, like, well, no. I said, well, it is until it ain't.
Hmm.
And,
right,
or
exactly.
It ain't until it is. So don't all this what if and maybe and all of that stuff. It ain't doing up a needless worry, you know?
Well, truly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I was telling somebody the other day, I said, when's the last time that you stressed about something and it helped you? And they stopped and thought about it for a minute and said,
yeah,
never.
No.
So that's an exercise in futility. Why are you doing it?
I get it, too. You know, stress is one of those things that you can't help.
Mm.
You have to really go inside yourself.
Oh, definitely.
And control it. But when stress hits you, the first thing you want to do is throw your hands in the air and scream and run down the street.
Mm.
But it was like, wait a minute, you know, let me get a grip on this.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, you know, if you're going to pray about something, you can't stress about it. Because that stressing cancels out the prayer. So if you're going to stress, don't pray. And if you're going to pray, don't stress. It's just that simple.
Makes plenty of sense.
You know, so I mean, that's kind of my
anybody listening, write that down.
Oh, I know what I meant to ask you. What kind of trombone do you play?
Right now I play a DeCarbo trombone. It's made of carbon fiber.
Oh wow.
Made in Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
And I had four other trombones before I got this one.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm not one of the people that just collects the horns. If I'm going to have a bunch of horns, I'm playing them.
Right.
And once I got this one, I wasn't playing the other ones anymore. So I was like, you know, this is a pretty good little nest egg in there if I unload all of these horns. But I'm only playing this one. Now, the story of how I ended up with it was I was playing on a horn made in Germany, called Amryan. Mm-hmm. And they hit me up and said, you know, Greg, you've been playing our horn for a long time now. I just want to let you know, we have now manufactured a carbon fiber trombone. And I was like, yeah, that's cool. So I started looking at other ones and stuff, and I, you know, saved some files, saved some links. And I went and played it, and I liked the horn, but it was a little bit smaller than what I'm used to. And it was so light. It felt like, it didn't feel like a real trombone.
Oh, wow.
Now, over time, could I have gotten used to it? Mm-hmm. Probably. But, you know, I liked the horn. I didn't love it. Mm-hmm. I liked it a lot, but I didn't love it. Mm. So I was just going through my files, and I was like, what is this link here? And I clicked on it, and I was like, well, I'm going to Zurich soon. So I just called the guy, Andy Keller. Mm-hmm. And he came out and got me, and it's a little, it's a shop outside of Switzerland, maybe about 20 clicks away, called Winterthur. Mm-hmm. And that's where this factory was. He let me play through some horns and stuff, and I said, I like it. He said, so how do I get one? He says, well, you go ahead and pay me, and then 30 days later, I have it put together and sent to you. And then I said, well, how about if I rep for the company? He says, well, we can knock a little bit off of that, mm-hmm. you know, if you want to rep for the company. And that's what I did. I've been a representative of DeCarbo Trombones for 7, maybe 8 years now.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
I just had the last podcast I did with a bass player, and he's been using Fender stuff forever. I'm like, yo, talking to the Fender reps, y'all. If any Fender reps are watching this, you need to hook up my man and get him an endorsement deal. Howard Cloud is his name. He's from Connecticut.
Yeah.
A bunch of people as well. But, yeah, so the reason I asked is because if you didn't have a deal, I was going to like, yo, I'm going to put the company on blast and let them know.
Yeah.
Y'all need to hook Greg up.
But this is what I've learned from dealing with people that deal with Fender. You know, they are an icon. They're an institution. Mm-hmm. They're more than just an instrument. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you think of a basic car, you think of the shape of a Fender.
Right.
So
right.
They're not clamoring really to get people to play their stuff because people are already coming to them anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, for the basses and the guitars.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, even Byron Miller, who probably played one of the most famous bass solos ever when he was playing Reach For It with George Duke. Mm-hmm. You would think that guy would be deserving of, you know, a Fender hookup of some kind. And right, they're like, right. Nah, not you.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's yeah. crazy. That's crazy.
And, you know, there are some people out there that don't have anywhere near the mileage, but they have some of that, you know, that newfangled popularity. And I ain't going to call no names, but, mm-hmm. you know, they got a Fender. Mm-hmm. And Fender, you know, hooked them up. And I was like, you know, they will go after some people and some they won't. And I say, if you are able to land that, you're doing something right. More power to you.
Right.
I'm proud of you.
Right.
But yeah, traditionally them, Gibson, and they're another one. I think Selmer, you know, saxophones and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
They're like, you know, everybody wants these. You know, why should right. we give out endorsements? You know, so and some companies are funny like that.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
to find somebody that makes a really good product, and they're saying, "Look, man, just speak for us, and we'll look out for you." Mm. It's a little bit on the rare side these days because, I mean, if you know anything about flying and 20,000 miles is a round trip ticket to anywhere in the country, those days are gone. Nobody's giving you anything anymore.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, the whole, it's a paradigm shift in the music business, you know. So,
yeah.
You know, it's truly not like it was, you know, and that's unfortunate on so many different levels.
I get it that things change, but to make a living at this now, it's almost like you have to think way outside the box. Like if I'm sitting on the box now, I got to think across the street.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, selling units and all that kind of thing, it's not profitable anymore.
Yeah,
first
thing
off,
in the past.
You'd be hard pressed to find anybody with a CD player. So
right.
You can't, unless somebody's got an old car or, you know, some kind of relic, kind of a modus operandi, and even turntables, you're not going to sell a lot by units anymore. And royalties have just gotten so slim with streaming and everything.
Right, which is another thing.
Yeah.
Because those streaming companies are killing it, man. They're making money, man.
Yeah. They're killing it, and the artists that provide the music for them are not getting jacked.
Right. And they're getting jacked.
And we were discussing earlier how people going on tour and they're not taking a band with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're getting DJs being paid millions of dollars to spend somebody else's music.
Right.
So, you know, there's maybe at least once or twice a week, I say to myself, I might be in the wrong line of work. But
yeah, man, you've been doing it, man. You've been for all these years, man. You know, I'm in
exactly.
It,
I mean, you know, I can keep some bills paid, and I love what I'm doing. And they say, if you love what you're doing, you never work a day in your life.
That's right.
But I don't know, man. Dragging my 66-year-old ass up and down these airports and stuff, man. You know, even if I enjoy it, it still feels like work.
Right, right. Well, what they say, they pay you for the travel, not for the music. They pay you for the travel.
Yeah, and they definitely do. I mean, the traveling thing, like I was saying about the airlines a minute ago, you know, those days of 20,000 miles or 25,000, it would get you a free round trip ticket.
Right,
that might
get
you an upgrade.
Right.
Now,
Now,
what I tell you, what I don't miss is the smoking section on the plane.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
It's funny. They had this thing. They call it a section with no partition, with nothing to keep this air from that air. It's just like, you know, if you're sitting in row 21, you can burn a cigarette if you want.
Right.
And that's the smoking section. But everybody in the plane can smell it.
Exactly. Everybody else getting secondhand smoke. But
Yeah.
I remember they had used to have the little ashtrays and the armrests and stuff.
Yeah, I remember
that. Yeah.
Shoot.
Wow.
Yeah, go to some of these classic car shows, and they still have the ashtrays in there and stuff.
Mm.
Now, you got to have an ashtray now. I mean, you do, but they're not as plentiful as they are in the older cars. Because let's face it, there's a lot of people smoking, and a lot of people smoking and driving.
Right, right.
And you do, if you don't want them flicking their cigarettes out the window and the hail and Smokey the Bear because half of the woods been burned down or any of that other stuff, man, you got to put an ashtray in the car.
I think all of the ashtrays in my cars, they got like felt or some kind of lining in them and stuff.
So yeah, they ain't made for something that would burn.
Yeah. It's like made to put coins in it or something. You know?
Yeah.
And there ain't a lot of them no more either. So that's another story.
This has been another episode of In the Black of My Mind podcast. Make sure you like, comment, subscribe and share. Until next week, y'all be blessed.